welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music on your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of our program examines diabetes. In part two of our program, we'll talk about gluten and the many people who have various kinds of intolerance to gluten, including those with full-fledged celiac disease, and the ways in which one can cope, actually quite remarkably, with this situation. That's coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD. In this portion of the morning show, we're going to be talking about something which is an increasingly prevalent and serious health issue among Americans, and for that matter, a health issue among many people all around the world, diabetes. And right off the bat, I need to say, in the interest of full disclosure, that this conversation is very interesting to me, not just in a theoretical and general way, but in a very personal way. Just over a month ago, I received the news from my own medical doctor that I am pre-diabetic, in fact, very high pre-diabetic, verging on diabetic. And so this is a sobering reality for me, in a sense, not a surprise given careless choices I've made for a long, long time in terms of diet and so on. So I have utterly transformed what I am eating, what I am drinking, how much I'm drinking, what I am doing, and in an effort to bring down my weight and hopefully bring down the dangerous numbers which indicate the pre-diabetic condition. So this is not just an abstract interest of mine, but one of very real importance. But I know for many others as well, this is an important conversation that we're about to have with one of the country's leading experts when it comes to diabetes, Dr. George L. King, Chief Science Officer of the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard Medical School. And he has studied diabetes for many, many years and has just written a book called The Diabetes Reset, Avoid It, Control It, Even Reverse It, A Doctor's Scientific Program. I should mention as well, I didn't seek out this opportunity. This opportunity just landed on my desk along with all kinds of other various books, but the timing was quite propitious. So I am pleased about this opportunity. The book is published by Workman Publishing, and Dr. George L. King, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could just say a word about whether or not there is any particular reason why this particular field has become the focus of your medical practice and studies and so on over the years. What drew you to the malady of diabetes? Anything in particular?
Well, I think, I've been in the field over 30 years, and initially the interest was because it's such an interesting disease and affecting so many different organs and such a major problem that I thought it would be very exciting to build my career on this problem. But about 5 or 6 years into my studies, my father developed type 2 diabetes, and then, which you may not realize, I'm Asian American, and this is diseases on lots of Asian Americans, even higher than the general population. So many members of my family and extended family have come down with diabetes. So this has now, as you have, as a personal interest as well.
I hesitated as I was doing the introduction to speak in terms of Americans. It's a great problem among the American population. I think we all know that. We hear about this all the time, along with, of course, the escalating numbers when it comes to obesity. And obviously, those two things are very much connected. What about sort of planet-wide? What kind of pervasive scourge is diabetes, or is it of peculiar intensity and an especially acute problem here in America?
No, actually, it's a huge problem all over the world, but mostly probably in the developed nations. So it's very high in the U.S., as you mentioned, Canada, you know, North America. It's very high in the Hispanic population, you know, Mexico as well, and, you know, South America. It's really similarly in Europe and Middle East is a huge problem. About 30% of people there actually have diabetes. But the really unusual places actually in Asia, in China, diabetes is only 1 or 2% in 1980s. Now it is 10, 12%. And the unusual aspect, not just because it's such a big explosion, is because the diabetes are so high, rate is so high there, even though the body weight is not that high. And so there's a paradox there as to why people are thin, yet they have higher rate of diabetes even than the U.S. because obviously our weight obesity rate is much higher than, you know, in China. So it's a worldwide problem.
Tell us about this matter of glucose in the bloodstream, because that seems to be the central critical matter which determines whether or not, in fact, someone is going to have a condition like diabetes. Explain what glucose is and the narrow range in which it needs to exist in the body.
Sure. So the glucose is a very critical fuel for us. Many parts of the body requires glucose to function. It provides energy and you know, warmth and everything for our body, so it's critical. We eat food to generate glucose, both from the food themselves and from the liver that makes the glucose. So body keep it in a narrow range, about 80 to about 130 level, milligram percent level. That doesn't vary too much until you become you know, pre-diabetic or have diabetes. So, excuse me. There's a body makes a hormone or protein called insulin that and glucagon, another hormone that regulate the glucose in a narrow range. For diabetic patients, either type 1, which is the juvenile diabetic patients, they actually the body lose the ability to make the insulin, or type 2, which is more adult onset related to environment there, that the insulin doesn't work as well, then the glucose starts to go up, and you can measure that in the blood. Or your doctor can measure something called A1C, and that could slowly go up. And then once you get to a certain range, then you're called pre-diabetic. And once you get past certain range, then you actually have the diagnosis of diabetes itself.
And that's one of the things I was appreciated learning from your book, because I think most of us are a little foggy when it comes to the two different types of diabetes, and we tend to think of all diabetics as suffering from, in a sense, a lack of insulin in their body for whatever reason. And of course, what you point out is that in the case of people with diabetes, that's more of the adult onset variety, we're talking about insulin being produced, but in a sense not being absorbed or properly used by the body. And you tell us in your book that there are a number of things people do, poor choices people make, which can lead to that condition, to that situation of insulin resistance. What are some of the most important?
Well, I think that a lot of things we could do, and the good news is many studies have shown that if you correct some of these or take steps to change some of these things, you could actually reverse it. And I think similar to you, I was diagnosed with pre-diabetes about, three, 4 years ago myself. As I said, my family has it, so it's not unreasonable that I would be at risk for it. So a lot of things you can do. One is the food you take in, both in total amount and in the type of food. For example, the American since 1980s have increased our food intake calorie-wise 500 calories per day more than 1980s, which is very high, because if you just eat 3,500 calories more, then you're going to gain a pound, right, if you don't change your activities. So one is you could cut down your total food intake by about 10%. So the way to do that is you could take the food, you come on the plate, you just right away move away aside about 10%. You know, we are taught not to leave anything on the plate, but you can leave 10% and not eat that. Secondly, is we found that if you could eat food with high fiber or high carb with high fiber, complex carbohydrates, not simple carbohydrates. So these would be vegetables, broccoli, snow peas, roots, radishes, and so forth. That would delay the peak of your absorption of your food, glucose, fat, and that then your body can handle it. But if you have a big meal, you eat very simple sugars, you have a huge peak, and then that would be more aggressive on your body, and it would be difficult to take care of it. So this is just some of the simple things. You could reduce your body weight by only 5%. So if you're 200 pounds, all you have to do is lose really 10 pounds or 15 pounds at most, and that can have dramatic beneficial effects, at least on the glucose part as well. And another thing is exercise. I exercise both on aerobic and weight strength training about the 45 to 50 minutes every other day. And a lot of people don't realize the beneficial effect of exercise lasts 48 hours. So you only have to do it every other day. I enjoy it. I do it. I like to do it every day because it relaxes me. So both improves the activity and also relaxes me, decreases stress. So some of these are simple things we can do to help.
We're speaking with Dr. George L. King, leading authority on diabetes, chief science officer of the Joslin Diabetes Center at Harvard Medical School, and we're talking about his book just published called The Diabetes Reset, Avoid It, Control It, Even Reverse It, A Doctor's Scientific Program. One very intriguing thing you say in the introductory chapter is this: no two cases of type 2 diabetes or prediabetes are exactly alike. The fact that so many different factors contribute to insulin resistance and beta cell dysfunction means that your own glucose control problems are caused by a unique combination of these factors. I think you spell it out very clearly there, the fact that although we can know about the factors that are important contributors to whether or not you have the proper amount of glucose in your system and the proper amount of insulin or the insulin's being absorbed, we know what affects that. The fact remains that for a given person, it's important, I suppose, to understand, in your case, what is going wrong. What of those contributing factors is the problem in my case? Is that a tricky thing to determine? Or for the most part, is the answer to that question fairly straightforward, albeit a little bit different for every single person?
Yes, I think your analysis is right on the money there, that genetically we're all very different. Since the genes are causing type 2 diabetes are so many, there's 50, 60, 70 genes all contributing to development of the diabetes. So all of us probably have some of it, but not all of us, in a different set. So we have to do different things to counter these problems. And also, our lifestyles are also different, right? So some of us live in a colder climate, some in a warmer climate. But the good news is the categories that we have outlined can all help. And the large study, which U.S. government supported to the tune of a few hundred million dollars, is called the DPP study. We won't go into what it means, but they have studies in Asia, in China, in Finland, in India. So all these changes that we have outlined, things that we could do, seem to work for every group of people. But again, there, certain things could be adjusted. So you work better for one person, not work for another person. So I think that is what we meant, that you really have to adapt our suggestion to your own personal lifestyle.
Right. I thought it was interesting, too, that the introduction to the book ends with several pages just devoted to five different important blood tests that you think all of the readers need to know about. And that, in a sense, helps underscore what a complicated problem this can be. The fact that there are kind of different things going on and that various blood tests are needed to really maybe fully assess the well-being of a given person when it comes to this particular matter. Without going into too much detail, because we have a lot more to cover, but just say a word about this array of blood tests that are really crucial in studying this in a given person.
Sure. I think that's very important, and this you need to work with your doctor to get, and certainly you need to measure glucose because that's the diagnosis for diabetes. And we have something called A1C. A1C is a average of your blood levels over the 3 month period. So that's very important because that could start telling you whether you're getting to become pre-diabetes and so forth. So for my example, when I notice my A1C level is start to go up and I get to a certain level in the pre-diabetes level, I start to do many of the things, such changes like diet and weight and exercise. So my level of A1C now is back down to normal or non-pre-diabetic levels. So I'm keeping it there. So that's very, very helpful. Another test that we often do is insulin level, which most doctors actually don't measure. The reason that may be important is that could help you to know whether adults could even get type 1 diabetes, right? These are the people who don't make insulin. So that is very important to know whether your diabetes is type 1 or type 2. So that gives you some idea of the tests that can be done.
You have this array of 8 strategies, which you call the Diabetes Reset Toolbox. And these are, in your words, 8 essential strategies for preventing and controlling type 2 diabetes. Some are more surprising than others. Some are pretty basic things that we've probably already heard something about in other places, although you do a great job of sort of spelling it all out, why they are important. For I think many people, it will be quite surprising to see the basic diet that you suggest, something called the rural Asian diet. First of all, is it called that because of what we assume, that is the population that tends to live with this diet?
Right. So we looked into this diet because we looked at the people in China mainly who live in non-urban area, who works on the farm and so forth, what kind of food they eat. And the reason for that is the diabetes rate in rural China is only about 1-2%. You can move 100 miles away from the farm, and in the big city, the diabetes is 12%. So we say, oh, okay, it must be environment, right? Because the genes can't really change that fast in 20, 30 years. So one major change is probably the diet. So that's how we start to call it that and start to investigate it, see what does it do.
As you are trumpeting this particular diet, you are also calling into question some very basic assumptions that a lot of people make. And for that matter, plenty of doctors make some of these assumptions about, in particular, carbohydrates, that a diet that avoids carbohydrates at all costs is the best kind of diet. And you simply don't believe that. What do you think is the mistake being made there?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, we thought about this. I already got a lot of emails since the book come out that take issues with it. But I think this misunderstanding. So what we are saying is that there are multiple diets, and they all seem to work well if you lower calorie intake. And so the key is really to lower the calorie intake. And the reason we thought this diet will work is because people who are eating it for centuries seem to do very well to control their diabetes. The reason we thought lowering the fat by half is amount of calorie per fat, proportion of fat, is very high. So you have to eat more fat if it's a high-containing fat food to really feel full. Whereas our carb content is very high, it's 70%, but it's all complex carb. So it's not like sugars and so forth. It's really all carbohydrate-containing vegetables, as I mentioned before, you know, broccolis, cabbages, Chinese cabbages, and string beans. And so these are all carbs, but they are complex carbs. So they actually have large volume, and so you feel full after eating a small amount. And your glucose, because of high fiber, your glucose actually don't go up that much. So those are the reason. Obviously, if you don't like this type of food and use other food, long as the calorie, total calorie is dropped, is also important. But if the carb is simple carb, and processed carb in processed food, then obviously you don't want to have that much carbohydrate. So you have to have a little understanding of, not all carbs are bad, as later on we could talk about. Not all fat are bad. So I think we have to be clear on that.
For that matter, we probably need to have a better understanding, all of us, about sugars and different kinds of sugars and those which are especially damaging to the body, and particularly for somebody who is poised on the brink of becoming diabetic or not. What's important for us to know about sugar intake?
Yeah, so I think the sugar intake, simple sugar intake, should be cut. Definitely decreased in most Americans, and as I said earlier, that has increased by 30-40% over the last 10-20 years. So that, in general, needs to be reduced. Another is the fructose-containing food are probably not good. For some reason, that's been added to a lot of processed food, so that needs to be reduced. So I think those are the main components. You can't remember. I can't remember that many things. So if we follow those two simple little things, I think you could go a long way.
Let me just ask you real quick, specifically about bread, and for somebody again who is trying to safeguard themselves from tipping into the range of diabetes or wants to avoid becoming pre-diabetic, for instance, when it comes to the consumption of bread. What kind of choices do you advise people to make?
Well, again, it's mostly carbs. And obviously, if you could eat the whole grain type, would be better. The amount you eat does not have to be, huge slices of them. Just similar, for United States, it would be bread, but for other cultures will be like rice. Then you should eat brown rice, which if you cook it correctly, tastes just as good as the white rice. In our rural Asian diet, it's all brown rice, brown noodles, soba noodles. So on the bread, I love to travel in Europe, and especially in Italy. Every meal they serve bread and pasta, and so it's very high carb, 60% carb, actually, the Mediterranean diet. And they have a fairly low diabetes rate, right? Low obesity, low diabetes rate. But if you look at it, the plates there is only 6 inches or at most 9 inches. In the United States, it's 10-12-inch plates.
Good point. Good point.
So and they give you one or two slices of bread, small amount of bread, small plate of pasta. So those are definitely okay.
Couple other steps in your strategy that I want to make sure we can talk about briefly. You mentioned something I'd never even heard about, brown fat, and say in your strategy for activate your calorie burning brown fat. If you can, in a minute and a half or so, just touch on what brown fat is and why it's important.
Sure. So brown fat is one of the biggest discovery, I think, in medicine in the last 5 or 6 years. Brown fat is our body's mechanism to generate heat. So in cold weather, especially, you need brown fat. Otherwise, you're going to be really cold. In babies have a lot of brown fat. That's why they're warm when you touch them. And brown fat is wonderful as a possible way to control our body weight, because it sits there and just burns up calories, generate heat. We don't have to exercise. It just burns up heat, right? So the question is, as we get older, we lose the brown fat or they get deactivated. So how can we activate it? So in order to burn up more calories. And this is where you could combine exercise with brown fat activation, because many places, exercise places, they turn up the heat. They, in a hot room, make you sweat, and you lose weight because of the fluid, not really the real body weight. But if you exercise at 62 degrees or 64 degrees, you actually will activate your brown fat. And so you lose calories by exercising. You lose calorie because you activate your brown fat, and naturally you're burning off more calories. And so this is a real target that many pharmaceutical companies are trying to develop drug to activate your brown fat. But there are a lot of natural things you could do to activate your brown fat. So exercise alone will activate brown fat.
Fascinating. Yeah. You also mentioned that it's really important that we get 7 to 8 hours of sleep every night. Do we even understand why this is such an important factor?
Yes, it's probably due to stress. How is this realized is in the sleep labs, you could take young people, 25, 30, and just keep them awake for 48 hours. Their glucose just naturally goes up after 48 hours, almost to the level of diabetes state. As soon as you let them sleep for 8 to 10 hours after that, the glucose became totally normal. So it looks like after 24, 40 hours, you really become stressful. Your body, all the stress hormones start to go up, and the stress hormone will inhibit the actions of insulin. And then when that happens, you're sort of producing a natural state of, you know, type 2 diabetes.
Well, that and much more information is to be found in this really fascinating book called The Diabetes Reset, Avoid It, Control It, Even Reverse It, A Doctor's Scientific Program, which spells out in great detail the 8 essential factors involved in the diabetes reset, and then a final portion of the book which lays out a 12-week implementation plan for those strategies. So a book which lays out the science very clearly and lots of practical suggestions on how to bring all of this into reality. Again, the book is published by Workman Publishing, The Diabetes Reset. Dr. George L. King, I thank you very, very much for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
In a moment, part 2 of today's morning show on WGTD, a look at gluten. What is it? Why does it cause so much in the way of health problems in so many people? And how can we put together a diet which avoids gluten, if that's indeed the choice which we need to make for whatever reason? A look at gluten with the author of Against the Grain, coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. A reminder that we are under a wind chill advisory this morning until 10 a.m. Otherwise, we'll have a cloudy day with light snow, very little accumulation expected. We'll eventually warm to a high of 17 degrees, but this morning, wind chills easily 20 below zero. We're approaching 20 minutes before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. And for this portion of WGTD's morning show, I am pleased and honored to be speaking with Jax Peters-Lowell about her newest book, The Gluten-Free Revolution. In this book, Jax Peters-Lowell talks about her own struggles with intolerance to gluten and an intolerance that so many people have, particularly here in America. And it, of course, is a reality with which more and more people seem to be wrestling. But many other people are choosing to live without gluten in their diets and are glad that they've made that choice, even though it means bypassing a lot of things that we have long taken for granted as staples of a standard diet. All of this is explored in Jax Peters-Lowell's most recent book called The Gluten-Free Revolution. Absolutely everything you need to know about losing the wheat, reclaiming your health, and eating happily ever after, published by Henry Holt & Company. Jax Peters-Lowell, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's great to be with you.
Remind our listeners, although I'm sure many people know your story, since you are probably the single best-known voice in terms of living without gluten, remind our listeners of what exactly was the situation with you that led you to have to make this choice for yourself.
Well, in the 80s, when no one had heard of gluten, much less celiac disease, when there were no gluten-free bakeries on every corner, I was diagnosed with celiac disease. I should say ravaged by it. I was very, very sick. It took a long time to get a diagnosis. And there was nowhere for me to turn, absolutely nowhere. So as I regained my health, I vowed I would become an expert on this. I would read everything about it. I would never get that sick again. And as I was reading and learning the serious facts about this illness, I was also becoming really, really good at going to a cocktail party and switching plates. And I was like a sidewalk scam artist. Nobody noticed the way I was making sure I got safe food. And so when I wrote Against the Grain, it was the first book ever written on the subject. And I put all of those skills and all of that information into a book that I wished I'd had when I was diagnosed.
When you describe what it was like to suffer with this at a time when it just wasn't well known at all, you go on to say beyond what you just said, there weren't gluten-free bakeries on every corner, but you said there were no gluten-free cartoons on The New Yorker, no jokes on late-night TV, gluten-free labels were unheard of, people stared, waiters glared. I mean, I'm really glad you say a word about that, because it helps us remember what it was like for those who suffered from this situation, that for the most part, they felt like they were suffering it in very much a unpleasant sense of isolation. And, of course, now that's one of the bits of good news, is that no one who suffers from this condition or makes this decision about their diet is alone anymore in the way that they once were, in the way that you were, for instance.
No, America has gone mad with gluten. It's obsessed now. And that therein lies the reason I wrote this new book. If there was no information in 1995 when Against the Grain came, there is too much information, or I should say too much misinformation. And that's why I wrote The Gluten-Free Revolution. I'm stunned at what I hear people say. You know, I'm gluten-free. Oh, here, let me order the seitan chicken. No idea that seitan is hydrolyzed wheat. I need to lose weight. I'm going on vacation. I think I'll go gluten-free. I'll try that. So I thought all of us need to be on the same page. And I honestly bit off a lot. I mean, this is a very big book, and it takes into account all the serious issues, all the information. Anyone, regardless of whether they have celiac disease or voluntarily gluten-free, needs to know about this is how we live gluten-free. How you do it is your choice. But I did it also, I wrote it, because we, those of us who are gluten intolerant or have celiac disease, we need everyone to be on the same page with us, or I should say the same plate, because we need to vet our information. It's in everyone's interest to all know what gluten-free is and how to proceed.
Can you say
then we all eat safer and we all eat better.
Can you say a quick word about what gluten is, in the sense that of why is it that it does the damage that it does to many people very seriously, and you would contend, and many people would contend, does damage to all of us, at least to a lesser extent. What is the property of gluten that makes it, in a sense, such a dangerous substance?
Well, gluten is gliadin and glutenin. Those are two proteins. Those are the villains in the play. They exist in wheat, rye, barley, and all the derivatives thereof. Not oatmeal or buckwheat, but they have to be certified gluten-free, otherwise they're contaminated. But they're not in, they have no gluten. Well, in those who are sensitive or intolerant, they cause those two proteins cause trouble going through the intestinal tract, but they also cause trouble elsewhere. That intestinal tract translates to neurologic issues, issues of fertility, all kinds of issues. Now, there are varying degrees of sensitivity. It doesn't cause a problem in those who are not sensitive, but it seems that there are more and more people who are sensitive, and there are no tests for that. So it's estimated that as many as 40% of Americans are now gluten-free and sensitive to it, but we don't have a test for it. We can't measure that level, although they're working on it as we speak. So it's not, you know, it does not affect everyone, gluten, those proteins.
Right.
But it does serious damage to the body in those who are intolerant or highly sensitive to it.
One question that I think comes up from a lot of people, and they don't always phrase it this way, but this is the way I like to phrase the question. How come Laura Ingalls Wilder and her whole family could consume gluten? And anyone who lived in America in the 19th century, I mean, although certainly there were probably some people who had some kind of intolerance to gluten, but there's no way that gluten could be such a central part of almost everyone's diet to the extent that it was once upon a time. Is it that we have changed, or that gluten has changed, or that these crops have changed? What has changed that suddenly gluten is so much more serious a problem than we presume it once was?
That's a great question, and it's the larger question. I ask it a few times in different ways in the book, and it almost makes me wonder if we are the canaries in the coal mine. Is the question bigger? Should we be asking, how are we growing our grains? How are we modifying our grains? How much pesticide are we using on our food? Because, interestingly, the use of GMOs, and I think it was 96 or so, food allergies of all kinds, not just gluten intolerance, have risen. The rates of autism have risen. All kinds of issues. Illnesses have risen. Our food is different. The food that our grandmothers ate was not modified, did not have excessive pesticide use, probably was more natural. I mean, in years ago, people ate vegetables and cooked meat, and, you know, they baked bread or they bought bread from the bakery. We didn't have convenience foods that are highly processed, full of high fructose corn syrup and fats and GMO empty wheat and pesticide. I mean, I think those are the questions we need to ask in our society.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not qualified to answer them, but I certainly raise the alarm. You can't do as much research as I have done and not connect some dots and not say, we have a bigger issue here.
You do such a good job, I think, in the introduction of the book of saying that there is a lot of good news here. And one of them is that when you have even something as serious as celiac disease, the right food is your medicine.
Absolutely.
And there aren't many conditions where one can say that. It's not a table full of medicines that you're going to have to take. You do say, you know, the bad news is, of course, there is much that you have to give up, including spontaneity, and that one cannot follow a gluten-free diet casually. I mean, one really does have to be careful. I appreciate the graph or chart that's in here in which you set aside certain foods that simply must always be avoided, and then others where we have to be careful about them, that sometimes they're okay and sometimes not. Can you say a word about that sort of confusing gray area?
Yes, I will, because, well, first of all, we have a gluten-free label. And that, you know, that's not perfect. That label is not perfect. And I think that we have to learn the ingredients in foods that we're buying. It's a glossary. We have to learn them. For example, in America, starch has to be derived from corn. But imported products use wheat starch. And in Europe, wheat starch is considered okay because it's 20 parts per million. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I could get into the weeds all day with it. But you have to learn it. And I would say quickly that to use the label only and not learn the ingredients, which are all in the book, they're all listed, is like, you know, using spell check before you learn how to spell. You really have, you trust yourself, you know, you have to trust yourself. And spontaneity is something that we can work on. We do lose some spontaneity. But I have to say that years ago, when somebody offered me a gluten-free pizza, which was so rare, or a brownie, I ate it. I could be stuffed, and I would eat it, because I never knew when I would get it again. But now we can say, you know, I don't think I'll have that pizza, because there are three places in my city alone where I can go and have a really, really good gluten-free personal pizza.
And so, you know that it will be absolutely gluten-free.
Absolutely, yeah. Gluten-free, yes. But I think that there are certain skills we have to still maintain, and that is in a restaurant where you maybe don't know the chef or can't really discuss it, when you order a salad, let's say, that has croutons and you really want it, you say to them, could you please toss my salad in a clean bowl? Because otherwise you're crouton-free salad is being tossed in a bowl that's already been tossed with croutons. Or could you scrape the grill to put my burger on? Little things. Or in an ice cream parlor, could you please wash the scoop? Because maybe your flavor, you know that your flavor is gluten-free because you've done your homework, I hope, online with the company you like. But maybe that scoop just scooped cookie dough.
Right. You have a list of basic rules of advice, and several are really interesting. I'll let you just grab whichever one especially intrigues you. But I appreciated basic rules like look for gluten in unexpected places.
Right.
Or it's better to look silly than to get sick. And if you don't understand it, don't eat it until you do. I mean, these are really great lessons, really for all of us to some extent, and particularly for those who need to or choose to live gluten-free.
Yes. I mean, you know what happens in a restaurant. I mean, one of the funniest things is a roux. A roux, R-O-U-X, is the basis for, I don't know, a trillion sauces, and it's always flour and butter. Mostly French sauces. So if you don't, you know, it's embarrassing not to know what that is. And, you know, it's not a cheek color, right? It's not rouge. So you have to, you know, you feel everyone staring at you. Could you tell me how this soup was made? Or I have this pasta. Would you mind cooking it for me? But, oh, by the way, could you please put it in a separate pot? Because otherwise you're in with the other flour water. So a lot of people make mistakes because they don't know and they're embarrassed about it, or they know a lot and they're really hostile and negative. It's not an adversarial thing. Chefs, I mean, by definition, chefs love to nurture people. Who would stand on their feet for 48 hours, right? So when you say to a chef, I would love to have that dish, but you know, I have to be gluten-free. I have to have a safe meal. Would it be just as good without this or that? Or is there something you can put? And if you do that, you have honored the chef. You don't want to ruin the chef's dish. And you've honored them, and they will just, as I like to say, eat out of your hand.
Your book also includes a wonderful section on gluten-free thinking, in which you pose a number of questions, and of course, there are all kinds of wonderful recipes as well. It's a tremendous resource for anyone who needs to live their life without gluten. Again, the book is The Gluten-Free Revolution, published by Henry Holt. Jax Peters-Lowell, thank you so much for this great service you've done to so many people,
and thank you for writing this book.
It's
good to be here, and I would say, go to jaxlowell.com, and there's much more information for your listeners.
Very good. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
Monday on The Morning Show, we'll spend at least part of the hour talking with a highly regarded operatic tenor by the name of Brandon Jovanovich. He is someone who has sung lead roles at the Metropolitan Opera, at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, and as a matter of fact, he's about to sing one of the leading roles in an opera which is being heard at the Lyric Opera for the very first time, an opera written back in the late 1960s, Holocaust-based, called The Passenger. And we will find out about this opera, long, completely unknown, never performed during the composer's lifetime. And we'll talk with Brandon Jovanovich about his interesting life and career. Born and raised in Billings, Montana, a football player turned opera singer. On Tuesday, Professor Art Sear from Carthage College joins us, as he does once a month, to offer his analysis of current events. And there is a lot to talk about with Professor Sear this month. On Wednesday, you'll hear the conversation I recorded with Rebecca Nation, a college professor who decided to become a college professor in order to understand much better the experience of her students. The result of that experiment, a year-long experiment, was a fascinating book called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student. Next Thursday, I'll speak with Juliana Hever about the so-called Mediterranean diet, which is recommended by many doctors, not only as an effective weight loss option, but also as a very good choice in terms of overall good health and well-being. Haver's book is called The Vegetarian Diet, The New and Improved Mediterranean Eating Plan, which gives the Mediterranean diet a vegetarian or vegan twist. And a week from today, from the archives of 10 years ago, my conversation with Blair Tyndall talking about her best-selling memoir, Mozart in the Jungle, Sex, Drugs, and Classical Music. You may have heard of the television series produced by Amazon, which has just been renewed for a second season, a TV series of the same name inspired by this best-selling memoir. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you can find The Morning Show archive on our website, wgtd.org. Click on Talk. Now to our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. A wind chill advisory is in effect for us for yet another hour, and otherwise it will be a cloudy day with light snow but very little accumulation. Headed for a high of 17, wind chills easily 20 below zero this morning. Cloudy tonight with a 50% chance of light snow, a low actually of 16, pretty comfortable. And actually tomorrow Saturday, cloudy skies, 30% chance of light snow and a balmy high of 29, then mark much colder Sunday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.